Case number 03-3154, United States of America versus Abdur R. Mahdi, also known as Chief, also known as Big Chief Appellant. Mr. Becker for appellant, Ms. Brooker for appellee.
Judge Henderson, members of the panel, good morning. I'm Robert Becker, and I represent Abdur Mahdi, the appellant in this case. I would like to primarily address the other crimes, confrontation, and multiplicity issues. I will be happy to address any questions you may have about the others, but otherwise I will submit on the briefs on those issues. This case brings to mind a maxim every one of us learned in law school. Never ask a question to which you don't know the answer. And the government's strategy in this case and the trial court's participation in it made that a very difficult, if not impossible, proposition. This court recognized in Gregory back in the 1960s that no witness is the property of either party. Witnesses are there, and in criminal cases, defense should have equal access to them. But in this case, the government's witnesses were bought and paid for. All of the civilian witnesses were cooperators, or they had been charged with other very serious crimes and entered plea agreements. And so the defense had no access to them before trial. And that problem is at the heart of both of these questions, the notice about other crimes evidence and about their ability to call witnesses.
When you talk about access, you don't mean literally access, do you?
Well, in Gregory, the court said the defense should have equal opportunity to interview witnesses. And in the typical case, with possible exception of complainants, eyewitnesses have no reason not to talk to the defense any more than they have a reason not to talk to the prosecutor. But in this kind of a situation where the government pretty much controls the witnesses want they were facing multiple life sentences, many of them, and they had no reason. If they talked to the defense, they would have jeopardized their own interests. So in very real sense in this case, the witnesses were just as much.
Is that the fault of the government? You speak of it, you use the term, the pejorative phrase, bought and paid for. These are cooperating witnesses who are citizens who saw crime and are participating in their civic duty to help out, right?
No, they weren't, Judge Griffith. These are people who were facing multiple life sentences in this case and others.
So what's the government supposed to do in a case like that when the witnesses are criminals?
Well, that's why it was such a problem that the government relied on 404B's notice requirement to say, we don't have to give you this information. And the judge enforced that, even though under Rule 16, she could have fashioned a broader discovery rule to provide the defense the ability to know what evidence was coming. The other problem, of course, is the dichotomy of intrinsic versus extrinsic evidence. Some of this evidence was other crimes. It was truly extrinsic, but the government took the position, and the judge supported that a lot of these acts were intrinsic to the case. And I know this court, including you, Judge Henderson, have expressed skepticism about that sort of dichotomy. In Bowie, the court talked about that dichotomy only serving the purpose of requiring notice or not requiring notice.
It has certain logic, doesn't it? In the sense that the other crimes, classic other crimes evidence, is peripheral, and there may be a very broad set which the defendant has only a vague notion, whereas acts that are part of the crime charged are presumably, even in a conspiracy, somewhat more central.
They are, but if in fact they're true, One of the things that you said in a case called Johnson back in 1992, you were interpreting Rule 12.1 and the alibi notice defense requirement, saying that one of the purposes of that was to prevent witnesses from fabricating testimony and from interfering with the government's cross-examination of these witnesses. Well, the same is true of cooperators. They have every reason to do the best they can to convict the person they have been called to testify against, because it, in a very real sense, will affect how long they serve in prison. And if it is a problem, if the government's or the public's interest in preventing fabrication and in promoting and protecting the adversary process is important in the alibi context, the same thing is true in a case like this one, where a tremendous amount of other crimes evidence was used, evidence for which Mr. Monti was never charged or prosecuted. And so the problem is just as great in this situation as it was in that situation that you had in Johnson. On the issue of the right to present a defense, there were several witnesses in this case. Some of them obviously would have had Fifth Amendment problems in this case. Sanderson, Laura Squashy, and several of the other cooperators, or people who were indicted with Mr. Mahdi and others. But there were others. There were Paul Tyler and Omar Washington, who would have testified about an issue regarding Hooker, who was the main witness against Mr. Mahdi as to several of the counts, or the only witness, in fact. And they would have come in and testified. One of the theories of the government's case that Mr. Mahdi was the leader of this conspiracy was that Hooker had come around at some point because he was a friend of one of Mr. Mahdi's brothers, and that Mr. Mahdi had brought him into this big drug conspiracy. The defense was trying to put on evidence that, in fact, A, Mr. Hooker had committed violent crimes before, and that he had sold drugs before. And the court pretty much let defense counsel, or counsel for those witnesses, argue that they had Fifth Amendment privileges, and then without question almost allowed them to assert that privilege on a blanket basis. Or in one case, or a couple of cases, one case refused to writ in a witness, and in another case refused to even give a day or two's time to find a witness who was out of the jurisdiction. And that was Reed, Curtis Reed. So in this situation, not only was Mr. Mahdi prevented from presenting or countering the evidence that against him that came in the form of other crimes, but he was also prevented from attacking the credibility and the bias and, in fact, whether the truthfulness, because the issue is, what did these witnesses actually see or hear? What did they actually fabricate? And that's a big concern in this case. On the issue of multiplicity, the government has said that we waived that issue, and in fact, I would argue that Rule 12b3 and Rule 12, I guess it's F now, are not even implicated by this kind of a defect, because technically it's not a defect in the indictment. It's because there's no prohibition against the government charging a greater and a lesser offense in the same indictment. The problem comes up when the case goes to the jury, and the jury is not told you have to decide on the greater offense before you even reach the lesser offense. And in this case, the problem accounted for over one-third of the substantive counts in the indictment, which were numerous. I mean, there were 49 counts in the indictment. 17 of them, two of them were conspiracies, but 17 of the counts were duplicative DC charges that should have been treated as lesser included offenses. I'd like to, unless you have further questions, I'd like to reserve the time.
All right. Ms. Brooker. Good morning. May it please the court. Stephanie Brooker on behalf of the United States. I'd like to begin first by responding to appellant's argument regarding access to witnesses and any issue with respect to the second argument in his brief. First, as far as the record, there is absolutely no record evidence that the defense was denied access to government witnesses. Second, there's no evidence in the record that the government's plea agreements prohibited cooperators from speaking with the defense. And third, there's...
I take it the argument is a practical one, that a witness with such a relationship with the government has no incentive whatever to talk with the defense counsel.
That's true, Your Honor, but there's certainly no prohibition. And the practical cure, if you will, when a government witness chooses not to speak to the defense attorney would be to cross-examine for bias. And throughout this very long trial, there are numerous instances of defense counsel cross-examining the government cooperators for their bias in light of the cooperation agreement. So that is how the bias or that issue is teed up before the jury. Second, with respect to the argument about intrinsic and extrinsic evidence, this case falls squarely within Bowie, this court's decision in Bowie. And again, I think it's important to note what the issues are here. It was two very small instances of cooperators having interactions with appellant involving a knife. And the proffered reason for it was that this is how the appellant kept crackheads, that was the language that was used below, in line. And so, first of all, there's certainly no harm regarding what came out in this case. And second, we would argue that the purpose that the district court allowed this evidence falls squarely within the Bowie analysis for intrinsic evidence. First, that it was part of the charged offense, and second, that these incidents were contemporaneous with the crime conspiracy actually charged.
Can I ask just what may seem to be a completely unrelated question? Why has this case taken so long to get to us? I think we counted 20 extensions of time that are uncontested by the government. Why? This happened a long time ago.
Yes, Your Honor. This case was tried in the spring and summer of 2003. And there were a number of extensions. I did review those in preparing for writing the brief. It did appear there were some transcript issues certainly referenced in some of the requests for extensions. I can't represent to the court the reason that the government did not oppose. I certainly was not involved in the case at that point, and I can't speak for our office policy on that.
Okay.
Next, with respect to appellant's comments regarding Mr. Tyler, Mr. Washington, the government would note, as we did in our brief, that those matters on which they wanted to testify, namely whether Mr. Hooker was involved in drugs from 1995 up to 1997 before the conspiracy began, the district court held that simply was not a material contradiction that extrinsic evidence would be permitted. Second, appellant's counsel noted with respect to witness Reed that the defense was not granted even a day or two to secure Mr. Reed's attendance, and that's certainly not the case. Mr. Reed's proposed testimony was brought up by the defense on July 15th. That was the first time they had raised it. They assured the district court that they could get Mr. Reed there by July 16th, which was the last day of defense testimony. And as we've laid out in our brief, that wasn't possible, and the district court ruled on a variety of bases why there was no need to wait for Mr. Reed's testimony. And finally, Your Honors, with respect to the multiplicity argument, our position is that this case regarding waiver is squarely governed by Weathers 1, that it is the exact same scenario of an indictment that charges DC code offenses and federal offenses, that is a defect that is apparent on the face of the indictment, and that if it is
if we disagree with you on that, what do you make of the argument?
If the court disagrees with us with respect to the waiver point, focusing first on the multiplicity argument raised in issue 1, We would argue, first, that the prejudice argument is just incorrect as a matter of law, that there is not legally recognized prejudice from being tried on the charges, that the decisions in Guy and Dale and Shepard all say that if there was some type of lesser-included offense, the remedy is simply to vacate the lesser-included offense and merge for sentencing, if you will. So first, with respect to multiplicity, we think there's not a legal claim, and second, of course, that it would be reviewed for plain error. We've also laid out, I think importantly, that the lack of precedent on the point certainly suggests that the error would not have been plain. If the court has no further questions, we would submit on our brief. Thank you.
All right.
Judge Griffith, to answer your question about the time, this case has been delayed at least for over the last year because of Boyle. Because at the beginning of the term last year, the Supreme Court took cert in a case called Boyle, U.S. v. Boyle, regarding that might have called into question this court's Perholtz decision. And so we asked that the court stay everything until the Supreme Court decided Boyle. And that's part of it. The other part was there were sealed transcripts, and it took a long time to get the entire record together in this case. The issue of how much other crimes evidence there was in this case, the government says it was two small incidents. The judge, if you look at the transcripts, repeatedly raised questions about whether this evidence was becoming cumulative, whether 403 was going to start being brought into this because of the amount of this evidence. This was not an insignificant amount of other crimes evidence. On the issue of Mr. Reed, defense counsel really did not have the ability to get Reed here any earlier, even though they said they had learned about him in the past week before the 15th of July. That was almost the end of the trial, until the judge issued a plane ticket and agreed to have a subpoena served on him in Memphis. They had no ability to get him here. So, you know, that to say that they had plenty of time when, in fact, on the 15th she made a decision, on the 16th she said, we can't find him, you have to go forward, really isn't very much time at all. And finally, on the issue of...
But it is correct that defense counsel didn't ask for a continuance?
They did. I think they did ask. They wanted to get him here, and the judge at that point said, the warrant is being returned, or the subpoena is being returned unexecuted. She, in effect, withdrew the resources that were needed to get him here. So for them to continue to object at that point, really the rules, they didn't then say, we now want a continuance again, but they really don't have to, because once they've made their point and the judge has ruled on it, they don't have to keep repeating it. On the issue of plain error in the multiplicity issue, when the judge instructed the jury, and in fact when she told defense counsel, the lawyers, that she was going to instruct the jury in this way, that I'm going to instruct them that they have to find every element of the underlying D.C. crime beyond a reasonable doubt in order to convict him on the Vicar count, the bells should have gone off in everybody's head. That is exactly what Blockberger says, regardless of whether you say this is a D.C. crime or this is a federal crime. If you have to find every element of one crime to get to the next, Blockberger says that's a lesser included offense. And because of the unique relationship here between the United States and the District of Columbia, this is the only place that becomes a real issue. Thank you.
All right, let me just ask you, on those six counts, distributing within 1,000 feet of the school, has the government conceded that those are duplicative?
I don't think it has, Your Honor, but I guess at this point the point would be the remand probably will be necessary at some level, and at that point I would assume that the judge is going to be, I will ask the judge to vacate the the distribution counts as lesser included of that, and resentencing will have to be done on that
all
as
right,
well.
Thank you. And Mr. Becker, you were also appointed to represent this defendant, and we thank you for your assistance.
Thank you.